infinite complacency, people went to and fro over the earth about their little affairs, serene in the assurance of their dominion over this small, spinning fragment of solar driftwood, which by chance or design, man has inherited out of the dark mystery of time and space.
Why don't you ask me what it feels like to be a freak?
Greetings, you are listening to Savage Science Radio here at Jackalope 105 FM, and I am your host, Tracy Savage. You know, few people appreciate just how badly our society will suffer under likely climate change. We're on the verge of unleashing runaway effects where nature's forces accelerate the impacts of humanity's emissions, and we get cascading, unstoppable change. Now, this is important to understand because we will leave an Earth a far diminished place with many parts unrecognizable. Avoiding such a fate is possible, but only with rapid, serious actions. Presenting climate changes and dangers at length and without an anecdote just leaves depression in its wake. An emergent story, though, is positive. There are new technologies growing at an astounding pace that can reverse CO2 emissions trends. Recent developments in Germany, Denmark, and China, and several U.S. States show the potential. This story begins darkly, but transitions to a discovery of solutions that can help build a much more useful conversation on climate change. And to do that, we bring you Fear and Hope, Climate Change and Policy Solutions, featuring James Follows and Hal Harvey. James Follows, he's an American print and radio journalist, if you're not aware. He's been a national correspondent for The Atlantic Monthly for many years. His work has also appeared in Slate, the New York Times Magazine, New York Review of Books, The New Yorker, and The American Prospect, among others. He's a former editor of U.S. and News and World Report, and as President Jimmy Carter's chief speechwriter for 2 years, and he was actually the youngest person ever to hold that job. The other speaker is Hal Harvey. He is the CEO of Energy Innovation. He's an engineer. He's a senior fellow for energy and the environment at the Paulson Institute, located at the University of Chicago. He was before that the founder and CEO of Climate Works Foundation, a network of 13 regional foundations and expert teams who promote policies to reduce the threat of climate change. From about 2001 to 2008, he served as environmental program director at the William and Flora Hewlett Foundation. And aside from that and other things, he was also on energy panels appointed by Presidents Bush and Clinton, and published two books and dozens of articles on energy and the national security issues, and speaks widely on energy topics. He served as a Rhodes Chair and Lecturer in 2005 in public policy at Arizona State University, and Mr. Harvey has BS and MS degrees from Stanford University in engineering, specializing in energy planning. And without much further ado, here is their conversation, Fear and Hope, Climate Change and Policy Solutions.
My name is James Fallows. I'm a writer for The Atlantic. I'm here briefly to introduce our guest, Hal Harvey, who has been one of the leading serial entrepreneurs and innovators in the field of energy and climate for several decades. His current firm is Energy Innovation. Before that, he was a founder and director of Climate Works and the Energy Foundation. He's well-connected in China and the United States, and the innovative ideas on what to do about the climate problems we're all familiar with are what he's going to discuss. The title of our discussion today is Climate Change, Fear and Hope, Climate Change and Policy Shift. Hal Harvey is going to give us an introduction, a narrated slideshow for a few minutes. When that's over, he and I will have a discussion, and then I will open the floor to questions from you. So please join me now in welcoming Hal Harvey.
Thank you, Jim. It's great to be here. A little bit of an echo so I can hear myself speak. This is entitled Fear and Hope, and like Marines in boot camp, I intend to destroy you and then bring you back newly made. So there's a lot to fear in climate change, and I'm going to talk about three aspects of it that are not commonly understood. The first has to do with weather. We think of climate change as increasing the global average temperature of 2 degrees C. That doesn't sound like much, and that's because it's not much. But that's not what matters. What matters is extreme. So I'm going to show you something interesting about that. Then I want to talk about how natural systems react to the man-made perturbations that we're causing. Then a little insight into carbon math, which is truly frightening. And then after that, I'm going to talk about some spectacular advances in technology that can bring this home in a reasonable fashion. I'm an engineer by training, and so I have to start with a normal distribution curve. Everybody's seen a lot of these. This one happens to be a representation of July temperatures across the United States, so now more or less. And because it's a normal distribution temperature, you get about a third of your summers are cooler than average, a third are average, and a third are hotter than average. Note down here in the extremes, there's very little stuff going on. And the extremes are what you care about. The extreme is the 100-year flood. It's the Dust Bowl drought. It's what's happened to Australia recently. So this is from NASA. Watch what's happening in the real world, if it goes. So you can see the actual temperatures very much fit this model for years. And then look what happened starting around the late 70s and the early 80s. We move the average over just a little bit. Here's where we are today. You can see we used to have one-third cooler than average summers. We're now down to one-twelfth. One out of 12 summers is cooler than average. One out of six is average. Four out of six are hotter than average. And one out of 12 are extreme. Never been seen before. Yesterday in Death Valley, it was 129 degrees, you probably saw. Phoenix, 120. Las Vegas, 117. Those are extreme temperatures. Let me give you some more examples. We had the biggest drought last year since the Dust Bowl. This is in Illinois. It was worse in Texas. It's worse today in New Mexico. Another kind of extreme is an extreme flood, an extreme weather event. Again, 65 out of 75 of Thailand's counties were underwater. Bangladesh has had more than half the country underwater. Australia recently had flooding the size of France. Another kind of extreme, heat. In Australia, they burned 1 million acres earlier this year through fires. The extremes become the norm. This is what's happening to our weather systems. We have to get used to it in a way. Australia had a day when the average temperature across the entire continent was 106 degrees. And in the hottest place, it was 122. That's not bearable. People remember Superstorm Sandy, a 1,000-kilometer-wide storm, caused $65 billion worth of damage. So this is what's happening to weather systems. It's not the average that we care about, it's the extremes. Now, you may have noticed that even as we were creating a lot of hot extremes, we were eliminating cold extremes. Cold extremes have an important ecological purpose, and around here they kill pine beetles. When you quit killing pine beetles prosper, and you kill pine trees. And there are now millions of acres of dead pine trees around here. So if you want to know what's happening with climate change, go outside. So that's the first bad news. It's the extremes become the norm. If you're interested in this, we have a short paper called The Extremes Become the Norm on our website. You can dig into it. Let me turn now to the next really scary thing. When human beings unleash changes, geophysical changes in the atmosphere, nature follows with its own medicine. And it's sometimes more extreme than that which we ourselves do. This is the Arctic. These are real images. The sunshine bounces off the snow. So you get a lot of sunshine coming in, hitting that ice, and bouncing off. But look what happens to the snow, or the ice, I should say, over time. It disappears. And when the sun hits the dark ocean, it doesn't bounce anymore. It absorbs. So we started this by melting the ice, and nature's accelerating it. It's a runaway cycle. There are several of these in nature. This is the one that's the scariest to me. There are millions of square kilometers of frozen tundra across the north of Russia, Canada, and Alaska. And embedded in that is frozen CO2 and massive amounts of frozen methane. Methane is an incredibly powerful greenhouse gas, 25 times as powerful per kilogram as CO2. If you melt the tundra, you release the methane. And there's no earthly way for us to stop that. Now, are we melting the tundra? We're starting to. The Arctic is warming at twice the rate of the rest of the world. It was 90 degrees in Alaska earlier this month. So the extremes become the norm, and systems go into runaway. Here's some other runaways. The warmer the air, the more its water vapor capacity. That makes clouds. Clouds are like blankets to the earth. They accelerate the warming. So each of these things causes more of the same. On the other side of it, we've had an incredible escape valve. Almost half of all the carbon dioxide that humanity has released so far has been absorbed by the ocean. But when you warm the ocean, its ability to absorb carbon dioxide decreases. So our safety valve is shutting off, even as our emissions are accelerating. Okay, everybody feeling depressed? I got one more. People have always talked about a threshold we should not exceed of 450 parts per million concentration of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. We're at 400 today, by the way. We just passed that threshold about 3 weeks ago. I'm going to argue that actually higher numbers, though they would seem instinctively to be easier to attain, are harder to attain. So we better stop now. And I'm going to show you why. This is simple math, but not widely dealt with. What we do as society by driving cars, by building buildings, by flying around in jet planes, is we emit carbon. And this is business as usual carbon emissions. Today, we're around here, 50 billion tons of CO2 emissions per year. And that's where we're headed. When you emit carbon into the atmosphere, it stays up there for a very long time, up to 1,000 years or more. And so if your emissions keep going up, your concentrations keep going up. Let me say again, this is what we do. This is what's done to us. This is the insulation blanket we're putting over the Earth, getting thicker and thicker. So let's say we get smart, we get clever, we get aggressive, we develop some willpower, and we reverse that trend, and we start pushing carbon dioxide down from its peak to close to zero over about a 50-year period. And I'm going to argue that's entirely possible. Look what happens to concentrations. They stay level. It's like putting money in a bank. You quit putting money in the bank, the money that you have in there doesn't disappear, it stays there, right? So if we go to zero carbon emissions, we stay at 450 ppm. Look what happens if you wait a little while. Let's say we wait another 25 years, and then we go to zero. That puts us in 650 world here. But look, here's the really interesting thing, and this is why I say the 650 world, besides being much worse from a climatological perspective, is actually harder. The economic change that we have to encounter is the difference between 60 billion tons of emissions a year and roughly zero. If we wait, it's 100 billion tons down to zero. The longer you wait, the harder it is to achieve any stable number, even a totally dangerous, ridiculously bad stable number. In other words, if we wait, I predict we go into absolute runaway, unrecoverable mode, into a time we've never seen before. By the way, today at 400 ppm hasn't been seen in 3 million years, since long before humanity. Last time it was 400 ppm in the world, it was 75. The oceans were 75 feet higher. So this is real. Okay, that's carbon math. What I want to turn now to is from fear to hope. That looks a lot better. But there's an intermission, which is called natural gas. Is natural gas good or bad? Both. It all depends. If you look at one thing, natural gas looks pretty good. If you displace coal with natural gas, then you're going to emit half as much CO2 at the power plant. But if you look at the full cycle of natural gas, you've got a few other problems. This is what I started with. This is the amount of CO2 from coal, and that's from natural gas. It would be a good substitution if you want to save the climate. But if you have very small methane leaks, remember methane is an incredibly powerful greenhouse gas, then some of that benefit goes away. If you have large methane leaks, gas is far worse than coal. So a reasonable question is how much methane is leaking. And the answer is no one knows. We don't keep track. And we've seen studies that have this high number, and we've seen them that have this low number. So we need to find this out. Let me say one other thing about clean natural gas. This is what it looks like when you're getting it out. It might be clean in your stove. It's not as clean in Pinedale, Wyoming. which is where this is. It's an incredibly land-intensive source. So I would say natural gas can be a useful bridge if it's managed very well. It can be an extension of a very bad addiction if it's managed badly. All right, now let's go to the real hope here. I have to figure out where to point that. I saw a headline in the newspaper a couple days ago that said, Nevada rejects coal, turns to renewable energy. And last month, the Nevada legislature outlawed coal, is planning to shut down their biggest coal plants, and they promoted renewable energy significantly. There are now 30 states in the United States that have requirements that the utilities deliver a certain fraction of their energy from renewable energy sources. The first one was in Iowa. The second one was signed by Governor George W. Bush in Texas. These things have been an incredible success, and they're just starting to show off. The Texas one has been expanded twice. They've built these unbelievable windmills here. Each of these sweep an area of 30,000 square feet, much bigger than a football field. These things are enormous. Other states have done this. California has already signed contracts to provide a third of its electricity from renewable energy by 2020. So you can begin to see the glimmer of hope in here. If California, pretty big economy, can go to a third, has already signed all the contracts, it's not so bad. Other countries are ahead of us. Denmark recently had a day when it was 100% renewable energy. Holy grail time, right? Their average is 41%. Now, Denmark's not a big country, but that's pretty interesting. And one of the things they've learned is how to manage the variability of renewable energy sources. So it's happening. When you build markets like this, when you stick with it year after year, you get this spectacular phenomenon. And this is the other reason for hope. If you drive prices down, you get dramatic increases in installations. Solar energy prices have dropped 80% in the last 4 years. Fathom that. We are passing the Holy Grail with this. Wind has dropped by close to a third. And the consequence of this is installations are skyrocketing. There are now several U.S. states that get more than 20% of their electricity from renewable sources. There are provinces in China that do this. And look at what's happening. Look at what could happen in the United States. This is our current electricity mix in the United States. It's dominated by nuclear, coal, and natural gas. And down at the bottom is biomass, geothermal, hydro, and wind. Solar is too small to even show up because it's just getting going. There was a study done by the National Renewable Energy Laboratory, an amazing place, in coordination with MIT. This is just over the hill near Boulder. And they said, could you get to 80% renewables in the U.S. by 2050? 80% renewables by 2050. They developed a model which is an hour-by-hour simulation of the entire U.S. electricity system from here to 2050, and they added renewable energy bit by bit. And they found the following, that you can get there, and the additional cost is relatively small. There's a lot of interesting lessons in this. It's a big story, and we can go into those more in conversation. But the bottom line is you can do it. And if you don't believe it, you should go to Europe, where they did a very similar study, sponsored, incidentally, by 12 of the largest utilities in Germany and the European Climate Foundation. And they said, we can go from these relatively low numbers, the dates aren't on here, maybe they'll show up in a minute, to much higher numbers. And today, in 2012, Germany's a quarter renewable energy. Germany's a real country. They have a real economy. They're getting a quarter of their energy from renewables, up from about 6% in a decade. So if they can go that far in a decade, and by the way, they're totally on track to hit these targets. It's not easy, it's not simple, but it's clearly possible. So I'm going to close with three slides. How do you win? You have to do three things. First, you have to manage fossil fuels. There are far more carbon in the earth ready to be liberated into our atmosphere than we can possibly tolerate. Many, many times as much carbon underground than the atmosphere can handle. And so if you do not put a lid on it, you lose. We lose very badly. So you have to phase out coal. Coal is, I used to say, it's perfect carbon sequestration. It's already in the ground, for God's sake. Leave it there. Natural gas, you have to get it right. You have to stop methane leaks. You shouldn't destroy everything. And there's a few other things like water quality you want to pay attention to. This, by the way, is the Rhone Plateau, a formerly very beautiful part of Colorado. The second thing you have to do is get very serious about energy efficiency. In every sector of the U.S. economy, you can cut energy use by a third to 70%. It's cheap. The payback's incredibly fast. Many of you saw the Nest presentation the other day. These amazing little thermostats. 15%, 20% just by changing your thermostat. Same with your lighting. And finally, we're going to have some very serious conversations with the electric utilities and emphatically with the public utilities commissions that set the terms under which they operate so that they divest from coal, they invest in renewable energy, and let them make money doing it. If the rules for the public utilities commissions are set right, this transition is a breeze. And if they're not, it's an awful struggle. So let me conclude with one thought, and then Jim can come up and deliver intelligence. And the thought is simply this. If you look around the people next to you here at the Aspen Institute Ideas Festival and the people you encounter over the next few days, you'll find an incredibly sophisticated, capable, networked, and influential group of people. These are the people who set the ideas that drive the country. Everyone in this place serves on boards of directors of nonprofits, runs corporations, has senior government positions, works with the media. And so I'm calling on you to make this agenda real. If we do not turn this around in the next decade or so, it's inescapably bad. We've been given a gift of technology where we can turn it around. And the difference is very specifically in the policies enacted that govern our energy delivery systems. We need to get those policies right. It's not that complicated. It's emphatically an idea whose time has come. So I'm going to put this all on you to help me, help us all get this done. Thank you.
Wired and you are not, so I can just sort of monopolize I can hold the stage. Actually, you may be plugged in. So thank you. This was a fascinating and compelling presentation. I want to sort of go through various of the implications for people like those in this room who've thought about these issues for a long time. First, I have to ask you, if this were a political talk show, if we were in D.C., there'd have to be some allusion to the debate over climate change, the debate over global warming, the debate over mankind's role in it. What is the state of the world outside the United States? Is there an idea of the debate or not? How should Americans think about the fact that we always talk about this as a debate?
Since you used the word debate, let me refer back to a line from the president's speech last week when he said that we don't have time for a debate of the flat Earth society. And he's emphatically right. This is simple math. You put carbon in the atmosphere. It's an insulation blanket. We can calculate how much carbon we're putting in. We can watch the temperature change. It's not complicated. So it's not a debate anywhere in the world except where it's been manufactured by people whose interests will be threatened.
So to say something about the president's speech. I think there's there's an important point of context about the president's speech. In the beginning of his second term, when he knows the clock is running, he's never going to run for re-election again, there have been three areas where he's laid down a marker. One was, of course, on gun policy. And we know, despite the moving presentation by Mark Kelly and Gabby Giffords, that without the Congress, there's almost nothing he can do about that. The second was in declaring very significantly that the war on terror had to come to an end. And there are things he can do about that, but he's in the middle of these two wars. And the third was announcing more clearly than he had before that climate change was an issue and a challenge and a moral challenge. How important did you think his speech and the ramifications thereof are?
I think the president did an amazing job. There are two reasons why I say that. The first is substantive. He scoured the laws to understand what the executive can do without going back to Congress. And the most important things in that, in fact, he's obligated by law to regulate CO2 emissions from power plants. They're a pollutant under the terms of the Clean Air Act. He has no alternative but to do it. So he's getting it done. And today, the EPA handed over to the Office of Management and Budget the proposed regulations for controlling CO2 emissions from new power plants. That's a really big deal. And there's some other really big deals in there as well. But the other one is the whole question of moral leadership. He raised this to a moral issue. He didn't do the pragmatic thing of, well, we can have a few more green jobs. He said, this is a challenge for our generation. And it emphatically is a challenge for our generation. So I think with this moment, he changed the conversation. And I think the debates of the Flat Earth Society are going to be increasingly ridiculed. And it becomes a question of how rather than whether.
And if you take as a premise, I will assert as a premise that within the next couple of years, he has no chance of getting actual legislation through the Congress to address these issues. Is the realm of executive authority significant that what's within the president's control?
There's quite a bit that can be done. Remember that Obama also caused to double the fuel efficiency of the automobile mm-hmm. fleet in America. That was a very big deal. Yeah. What he's doing with coal plants is a big deal, and his work with HFCs in coordination with China. These have zeros behind them, a lot of zeros. They do not sum up to a national energy policy. And part of the problem is we don't set energy policy in Washington. There's nobody in Washington, D.C. whose job it is to write energy policy for this country. We've never had a national energy policy. It's done state by state very significantly, which is why the public utilities commissions are so important. But I think your bigger question is, what about Congress? I think it makes sense to put a bill before Congress, a very simple, very clean bill, and let them fight and see what happens. Because you got to sometimes have the battle. You can't tippy-toe around it forever.
Yes, you got to have the battle. We know how that will turn out in the next 2 years, and we'll see in the longer term. Let me ask you a meta question that I imagine on the mind of most people in this room. The presentation, the title of your presentation is Fear and Hope. I thought the fear part was much more compelling and immediate than the hope part. You're talking about these global processes that are accelerating at breakneck pace, and that if we are able to do a number of these incremental changes, we have a chance of arresting them. It doesn't seem that hopeful.
Well, I'm more hopeful than I was 2 years ago. And there are two reasons for this. Technology can move very quickly into the marketplace. There's some technologies that move slowly, like a coal plant lasts 60 years. Or longer. It lasts as long as you want. So you have to consciously shut those down. But there are others that just are whip fast. Solar energy, these small modular technologies, don't have the constraints of the big lumbering giants. And on the demand side, too, it's a technology revolution. These LED bulbs mm-hmm. use one-tenth the energy of a standard light bulb. They're almost free, right? I mean, it's an amazing bargain. So technology saturation is unbelievably rapid when it gets going in certain realms. And I see those growth numbers. We're seeing double-digit growth numbers across every one of these technologies. The other is I give a number of talks at universities around the world, and they are ready to go. The students, the younger people, they're moving into this profession. They want to make a difference with this. They're not going to stand still. And we've already seen in the last election how important it is for that next demographic to take charge.
And we were talking earlier about the difference in attitude among some college audiences and some more mature audiences about their perspective on whether there is hope here. And I asked you about the analogy to attitudes on same-sex marriage, where you knew the turnover was inevitable and rapid because generation by age group by age group, the opinion changed so starkly. How about the opinions on climate change? Does that also have a generational correlation?
It certainly has a generational correlation because a lot of these technologies are new. Mm-hmm. It's also because in people's hearts they understand it's such a big deal. Yeah. I just want to say one more thing about how fast things can turn over. When we had World War II, it was a defining moment for this country, and we had to mobilize amazingly. And we turned Detroit away from manufacturing cars into manufacturing mm-hmm. war trucks and tanks, more or less overnight. So if you have some willpower, if you have some political will, you can get some things done.
Right. The U.S. went from making a couple of hundred airplanes a year to 100,000 airplanes a year within 3 years. But that, of course, is the idea that the United States can do anything when its attention is drawn. So the question is, what will get its attention? One other question on the speed of transition. When the Chinese boom in solar power is discussed in D.C. or in industrial circles, it's often with condemnation for their destroying the price, for dumping things onto the market. Should that be viewed instead as a positive thing to have driven down the price so rapidly?
Brilliant. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, Hank Paulson said 2 days ago, we're attacking the Chinese for selling us cheap solar panels, and we're trying to double our coal exports to them. I mean, what? It's crazy,
yeah.
Right? No, look, a lot of solar companies went bankrupt. Why did they go bankrupt? Because their competitors beat the tar out of them. That's a good news story. Yeah.
So if you, as you mentioned earlier, the members of this audience are influential in their personal spheres, and they have lots of influential networks of people in their communities, their businesses, their universities, and all the rest. What's the triage list of the things you would like people here to support? You had the three priorities of fossil fuels and energy efficiency and the renewables. In practical terms, if somebody goes back to Palo Alto or goes back to Atlanta, what message should these people be taking?
Well, the first and most important venue right now is a fairly obscure one, but therefore especially susceptible to this kind of intervention. And that's, I mentioned before, the public utilities commissions. We spend globally about $5 trillion a year on energy. That money exists. That cash flow exists. The rules as to whether that money lands on green choices or brown choices are set significantly by public utilities commissions. 60% of the carbon in America goes through pipes and wires that are regulated. So tell your governor who appoints these commissioners and tell the commissioners themselves you're ready for a change. Make it known. They get precious little input. They notice when they get it. Yeah.
And what are the main forces on the other side? Is it mainly fossil fuel companies? What do you view as the correlation of forces that you are trying to move?
There really are two types of forces. One are people who actually make a lot of money by hydrocarbons that they've bought that are embedded in the ground and for which they exact a profit when they are released into the atmosphere. And they will defend those assets to the nth degree. Now, mind you, if you live next to me and I decided I didn't want to put in a new septic system, I wouldn't be allowed to just dump all my sewage on your land. That's what they're doing, right? So it's an artificial asset. It's an artificial set of anticipated profits, but they fight hard to defend it. The other one is a more tricky one, which is, again, I'm going back to the utility system because that's where most of this change has to happen. Incumbent utilities are not the most dynamic actors in our technological society, right? They're kind of sleepy. They're run by civil engineers. Yeah. I know I am one.
And they're risk averse for good reasons.
Right, yeah. Right. They have time constants are in decades. Yeah. And they have never been subject to competition in a meaningful way. Most of them haven't. Yeah. And so it's institutional inertia rather than malevolence.
So I'm hopping around among a number of topics just to get them out of the table before we turn to the audience. Again, if you had a hope, fear and hope balance in which I am asserting the fear looked more fearsome, but we'll hope the hope kicks in, how should we think simultaneously about adaptation and mitigation efforts? That some of that carbon is going to be in there forever, as far as we're all concerned. Things are going to get warmer, even if every part of your program is adopted. What else should we be thinking of? And in what framework?
You know, maybe the best thing that could happen in America is for every state to be required to do a serious study of the costs of adaptation with a meter sea level rise, which we're going to see this century, I predict, and with the extreme events. There are going to be so many zeros on that thing, they might look to avoid it. Mm-hmm. So I'm definitely in the ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure camp, and I would put the vast majority of the money on avoiding the trouble rather than trying to... I mean, you can't really moat Florida. I don't know if you'd want to.
How many Floridians are here? There's only a few, but there are enough that we won't make it.
But you're walking ankle deep in water in Miami in 2100 right now, the way things are going.
Yeah. So. And when it comes to how do you feel about the whole geoengineering? Is that a fantasy or is that something that needs to be part of the arsenal of consideration?
It's a highly dangerous fantasy. When we try to mess with big, nonlinear, unstable geophysical systems that we don't understand, we're much more likely to do harm than good. I'll just give you one example. You can dump sulfur particles in the atmosphere and it make the sky white instead of blue, not what I want. And it would bounce off sunshine. White bounces off better than dark. However, you're still accumulating carbon emissions and the ocean is still absorbing carbon emissions, and so the ocean becomes increasingly acidic. Yeah. So you still kill all the marine life, even though you didn't warm up quite as much. And then let's say you do this for a couple decades, and then somebody forgets to maintain the machine, or there's a war, civil disturbance, and you turn off that sulfur. You have to keep that thing going forever. Otherwise, you shock the system, and then things really will go kablooey. So I think, the only kind of geoengineering I like is planting trees. I think that's a pretty good idea. Painting roofs white, There's a few things that make sense, but they tend to be at the community scale rather than the geoscale.
Let me ask you about one other thing of how we should fit it into our minds, which is coal. There's when I was living in China recently, I was hearing talking to a lot of your counterparts there who were saying that even though they're going full speed ahead on every other kind of energy, they still are burning more and more coal, and so is India going to do, and so is Iran going to do, and all the rest. How should... Is it a fantasy to think that we can limit the amount of coal? Should we concentrate on carbon sequestration or other efforts to dampen down the harmful effect of coal?
So, Jim, you've spent more time in China than me, and you know these issues incredibly well, so I'm going to ask you to answer your own question. I'll put in a note, but...
You can steer me towards the correct answer.
Yeah, right. China's not going to let the lights go out, and China has a lot of coal. And so China's going to burn a lot of coal. The rich industrialized nations, several of them, the UK, Northern Europe, the United States, are turning away from coal at actually a pretty rapid pace, and it's going to keep going. It'll go up and down. It's gone up for a couple of years in Germany, but it's going down, same in the US. So we're going to prove that you can run a modern industrial society without coal. The Chinese adoption patterns, they compress decades into months. They will follow. They're already building much better coal plants than any that exist in America. A third of the plants they've built have been used to shut down the dirtiest old plants. That's pretty good. And they're talking openly about peak coal. So my question is, when does it happen, and how fast is the curve?
And so I have I hesitate to give any opinions at all in your presence, but my impression in China is that they just are going to keep burning more coal for a while. It will eventually peak. And the valuable thing the U.S. can do is with the close partnerships that you and many other people have forged between international and Chinese scientists, turning Chinese power plants into the world's laboratory to try to do this in as clean a fashion as possible. So Godspeed for what you and many others have been doing there. One other question, skipping around. When you're talking about natural gas, you had a sort of apart from that Mrs. Lincoln type of, how was the play type of idea, because it could really cut emissions. Yep. On the other hand, it could be catastrophically worse than coal itself. In American politics and American industry right now, natural gas and fracking and shale gas is seen as the salvation in 15 different ways, energy independence, et cetera, et cetera. How do we think about this possible catastrophic risk that it includes of methane leakage?
Right. So, again, at the meta level, if you're a crack addict, you don't switch to heroin, right? You really want a pathway off. Mm-hmm. Now, natural gas is a really beautiful fuel. It does burn clean. We do have a lot of it. And honestly, a lot of these renewables have issues. They all have issues. Mm-hmm. Every single energy source has issues. If it's a calm day and a hot day, you want your air conditioning to run. You want your lights to stay on. The right role for gas, in my opinion, is to turn on quick, to run hard, and to shut down. So you have a combined cycle natural gas turbine power plant that runs 200 or 300 hours a year, or even 1,000 hours a year. It plays an amazingly valuable role. We're taking this precious resource and we're using it exactly as we should, because we're balancing the renewables, and we need that. We don't have cost-effective batteries. Maybe we'll get them, but we don't have them. So I guess at the top level, you can say, should it be free to pollute the skies forever? No. Even at the University of Chicago, they say no. And then you should say, to burn as much gas as we're burning, natural gas wells, these new fracking wells, decline incredibly rapidly. So within 3 years, they're about 70 or 80% gone. You got to go drill the next one, right? It's like the Red Queen in Alice of Wonderland. You have to keep running to stay still. So we have to ask, how much of our land are we going to turn into Pinedale, Wyoming? How much of our water are we going to threaten? Now, gas can be done well. I'm not anti-gas by any means, but I want to use it for what it's best, not just for every old thing.
And how about this crucial uncertainty about whether the leakage is a small thing or an enormous thing?
So the Environmental Protection Agency is doing a big study on this. There's a group of oil companies working with Environmental Defense Fund doing a study on this. Lawrence Berkeley National Lab is doing work on this. And I think within 3 or 4 years, we'll have a pretty good handle on this. There's some great new instrumentation that tells you these answers.
Yeah. So you've worked around the world on these issues. Most people in this audience, not all, but most are Americans. How should we think about the American role in global climate issues? Are we seen as a laggard are we seen as a force for good, in particular in dealing with the Chinese? So how is our, what is our country doing, and what else could it be doing?
If you go to the international stage where climate negotiations happen, I sometimes say this entire process was invented by Dick Cheney in order to ruin people's spirits and hearts about environmental protection.
He succeeded in that so many other fronts.
So don't get your hopes up for the UNFCCC to solve the problem. I wish they could do it. They won't. And they hate
the Commission on Climate Change, right? Yes.
Yeah, the United Nations Convention on Climate Change. They hate the U.S. there. Why? Because we come with no tons and no money. And they want to be paid for our old emissions, and they want to be paid to transform, and they want us to commit legally to reduce our... We're not going to do any of those things. Flip it around and go to the states, and let's start with Missouri, which is the show-me state, I think, right? If you do the right thing, if you build the right technologies, if you prove it's cost-effective, they will imitate, they will follow, they will join you. And again, Hank Paulson said yesterday, is cooperation or competition? It's a nice mixture of each. So in California uses half as much energy per capita as the U.S. as a whole. They flattened out when Jerry Brown was governor the first time, and the U.S. kept going up. So, and it saves about $1,000 per family per year. Not a bad deal, right? California, as I mentioned before, signed contracts to get a third of its energy from renewable sources. California is where the American dream lives in the minds of the Chinese, not Washington, D.C. Right. So there are now 30 states that are moving in this direction. Mm-hmm. That's how we're gonna work with other countries.
And how about U.S.-China in particular? Are they more working together, working at odds? How would you describe that landscape and that interaction?
So there's been a nice shift, and by far the most important moment of this was when President Xi Jinping and President Obama met in Sunnyland, when it was about 100 degrees recently, and they agreed to work together to cut the emissions of HFCs, hydrofluorochloro-somethings. These are incredibly potent greenhouse gases, and they're very cheap to get rid of, and that's a big deal. If that is done, if that is followed through, and it's not, that's not certain, but if it's followed through to full force, that equals 80 billion tons of CO2 emissions. That's a very big number. And the Chinese didn't have to do that, and Obama didn't have to do that, but they're the only two countries that can make it happen.
And what stands between their agreement and that actually happening?
There's some diplomatic mumbo-jumbo, which is that the UNFCCC, that failing organization, I'm going to get in trouble, is supposed to handle that problem, and they're not very good at handling that problem. And so they're trying to move it over to the Montreal Protocol, which is a brilliant, brilliant methods for handling those problems. That maneuver requires international diplomacy. John Kerry's on the case. He's working on it very hard. And it's going to require some cash, single-digit billions worldwide. Mm-hmm. And I actually think what China should do right now is step up and say, we're going to put up half the money, mm-hmm. and we're going to cause the politics to happen. It would flip their image in the world.
Because China's growth is so rapid, because its pollution is so horrible, because the connections between U.S. and China are so intense, we tend to talk a lot about the U.S. and Chinese interactions. How about other places like India or big oil producers in the Middle East or Africa? What's the general picture on how the U.S. is working with them or not working with them?
In a lot of these places, the U.S. is not that relevant. Mm-hmm. I mean, India is such a vast, complicated, domestically driven economy. And the problems they have are so profound and so severe compared to the ones even in China. There's a very strong popular sentiment in India, probably stronger than any other country I've visited, to go to clean energy right away and to skip the dirty phases. But the political system is so sclerotic, it's hard to translate that into actionable policy. Nonetheless, they've done a lot of good things. They have a tax on coal in India, and they use the money to pay for solar. We don't do that, right? So in India's... I have a lot of hope for India, but it's a very long process. I think the Middle East is fascinating. Right now, they burn oil in the Middle East to make electricity. Therefore, the opportunity cost of that is extremely high. And so they've made huge commitments to solar recently, which makes sense, right? They want to sell the oil. They got plenty of sunshine. Just go. I don't know how fast it'll happen, but again, they have plenty of capital. So that could be a game changer.
So I'm going to return now to the fear and hope balance and just ask you to go into this a little more before I turn it over to members of the audience for questions. I think everybody here, everybody who takes the time to attend one of these Ideas Festivals, is interested in and concerned by the ways in which societies deal with their challenges. You know, it strikes me, I've spent a lot of my life living outside the United States. America's objective challenges are relatively modest, and you know, with small changes in its policy, it could address them. This is one of the bigger ones. Through our history as a society, we've had ways to deal with big challenges. My magazine, The Atlantic, as Anna Deavere Smith was saying at that wonderful presentation, was founded as an anti-slavery magazine. And that was its initial commitment. There have been other big crusade, tumultuous moments in our history in the 1890s. Certainly, as you said, in World War II, we transformed everything. How would you equate both the politics and sort of the ethics of this moment to other parts of our history? What is this like? It's not like World War II because, you know, nobody has attacked us. It's not yet like the sort of not like the civil rights movement in the 1960s or even the Cuyahoga River catching on fire, although right. You could say that Las Vegas is similar to that. So how do you think about this in the larger sense of democratic societies that tend to be driven by inertia and rather just, you know, pay attention to their own families, confronting large, slow problems?
Well, you nailed it, Jim, because this is a large problem in the sense that it transcends national boundaries. There's no one country, even China, that can solve this, or even the U.S. And so you have to have tacit or explicit cooperation. Well, that's hard. Anything that transcends national boundaries also transcends job descriptions. It's nobody's job description to save the earth, right? It's your job description to defend your own country. And then there's the time. Slow, right? This is a 10-year problem. It's a 100-year problem. It's a millennial problem, even. And people aren't paid to think past the next quarterly report or the next election cycle or the next news deadline, for goodness sakes. So we have to do something that's unnatural, which is we have to quit living by instinct and live by intelligence. And human beings are not especially wired to that. The Ideas Festival is a good place to begin that journey. That said, we have at times grappled with big problems and dealt with them quickly. The Montreal Protocol I mentioned earlier. Now, that was a simple fix. But you know what? If they hadn't done that, we would have destroyed the ozone layer and actually killed millions of people and millions of species as a consequence. That was a very fast, quick. We went from science to reality.
And why was that possible?
Well, the real answer is because it was chemistry and not thermodynamics. You can get factors of 100 in chemistry easy. New cars today emit 99% less conventional pollutants than old cars, nitrogen oxides, volatile organic compounds, and so forth. But thermodynamics gives you 1% at a time, and it's really hard. And so to double the fuel efficiency of the car is a 10 or 15 or 25-year project. The other thing is, it was a tiny part of the economy for which there were ready substitutes, and energy is ubiquitous. Yeah. And there are no ready substitutes for energy except intelligence and energy efficiency.
And you made one point as an aside that I think it's obvious once you think about it, but it's really worth absorbing, which is the fact that Moore's law does not apply to energy production. And would you expand on that for a second? Because it really is important to absorb that.
So Moore's law is the idea that chip speeds and computing capacity doubles every 18 months. That's what, a 70% improvement per year or something like that. Thermodynamics is the most unyielding of all sciences. And thermodynamics is very simply the amount of useful energy you get out of something compared to the amount of raw energy you put into it. So in an automobile today, we get about 20% of the energy in gasoline comes out in motive force, and 80% goes up the tailpipe in heat. It's a pretty depressing number. The best power plants in the world get 65% efficient. They're not going to get to 75% very easily. You can do tricks and get them up there if you do, like in Sweden, they do combined heat and power and so on. But you're not going to get doublings and doublings and doublings, right? You, however, can get the subtractions on that order. And this is what's interesting. This is why energy efficiency is such a breakaway. As I mentioned, 90% reduction in energy from lighting. That's a pretty great deal. You can do that in all kinds of processes. I talked to a very senior technologist yesterday who thinks you can eliminate the need for carbon emissions from cement. That's 5% of global CO2, right? So subtraction is nonlinear, but production is a little more tricky.
One last question, then I will ask people to go to the microphones back there. So, as societies deal with change, there are some challenges that you can deal with on an individual level, sort mm-hmm. of individual boycotts, individual purchasing decisions or whatever, and there's some that require systemic changes, otherwise it's just meaningless. You know, I could decide never to turn the lights on in my house. That would be much worse for me than it would be good for the world's energy system. Are there any individual behavior changes that actually make sense in this field, or is it more a matter of if you don't change the system, it doesn't matter?
I'm going to give you my old answer and my new answer, because they're slightly different. My old answer was, much as you say, I believed in what we call the green citizen instead of the green consumer. The green consumer walks around and buys recycled toilet paper and green light bulbs and stuff. Green citizenship doesn't amount to a hill of beans, honestly. Then there's the green consumer. Green consumer doesn't. The green citizen insists that we run our apparatus, our political apparatus, in a way that delivers ever better results. And that's the renewable portfolio standards or the fuel efficiency standards. But here's why I need to adjust that a little bit. There's a link between the political and the personal. And so when you go to your house and fix it up and put some solar panels on and get a negative electricity bill, my electricity bill last month was minus $105. Wow. You know, you become a believer, right? It's not that hard. It didn't take any time at all to turn my house into an energy source. I mean, really.
But it also required a system change to set up the grid that way.
To be sure. But the point of it is, if you do that, if half the people in this room do that, they're going to talk to their friends, they're going to talk to their political leaders. It takes it out of the world of mumbo-jumbo and puts it into the world of reality.
So in the far back, we'll start back there, and I think microphones will come to you.
Hi, great talk. I'm David McConville with the Buckminster Fuller Institute, and I'm curious about something you referenced earlier, kind of this distinction between geoengineering and what you might call eco-engineering, where a lot of the large-scale interventions that are discussed from a purely engineering perspective aren't really taking the entire system into account, versus things like holistic management, reforestation. And I'm curious, in the calculus of what you've been looking at, have you seen kind of a quantified understanding of what these types of eco-engineering approaches could do that work with ecosystems instead of just trying to intervene within them?
I've seen snippets, but not a cohesive whole. I mean, one kind of geoengineering that we're doing is tearing down the world's forests, right? That's geoengineering. It's not very smart. So stopping that solves about 20% of the problem. So you might call stopping something bad a kind of geoengineering. Art Rosenfeld, a physicist at Lawrence Berkeley National Lab, says, what if you replace all the roofs in the world with white roofs? And you do it as they fall apart. That turns out to give you high single digits returns against this problem. That's not a hard thing to go along with. My own sense is that you should do things on a scale where you're not going to cause catastrophic failure, right? And that is an ecological scale that you have to be able to understand. If you're going to plant trees, plant native species. Right, you can even do small scale things that wreak havoc, and you shouldn't do that. But I think you have to understand nature's designed for a certain resilient outcome, and if you tamper with that in a major way, you're going to get whacked.
So I can't see very well them. So I'm going to ask the microphone holders just to go to people, and so whoever the microphone holders have, they're the deciders. Yes.
The CO2 that comes out, can it be recycled again and used in some way?
You mean being captured at the smokestack or after it gets into the atmosphere?
Capture it at the smokestack and therefore turn it into something useful.
And there are some projects in that regard. Yeah, yes, go, please, go ahead.
So can you capture CO2 after fossil fuels are burned and use that for productive use? It is right now being used, ironically, for enhanced oil recovery. So you go to an old oil field that's not doing so good, and you pump a lot of CO2 in there, and you get some more oil out. That's economical. It's actually an interesting strategy to develop new technologies. If you're going to do sequestration of the general idea of carbon capture and sequestration is that you capture the carbon, you separate it from other exhaust gases, you compress it until it's a liquid, you pipe it to a stable geological reservoir, you stuff it down in there, and then you put a plug on it. And that's carbon capture and sequestration. The problem with it is it pretty well doubles the cost of electricity. And nobody wants to do that since there's no price on carbon today. It also requires engineering feats of absolutely heroic proportion. There are ideas about using carbon dioxide for cement, which didn't pan out. They use it in Coca-Cola, but it's not much.
And then Pepsi.
Excuse me, Pepsi as well.
So would I microphone? Yes, somebody over here, I think, yes.
Can you talk to the economics of the renewables? In other words, as we look forward, what today and what 25 years from now is likely to be the most economically attractive renewable? I thought your comments on using gas was very enlightening, because what you're saying is you use that when you can't use something else. You can turn it on, you can turn it off. But the economics today, if you remove all government subsidies and you just look at what it costs, how does wind stack up against solar, against nuclear, and so on?
It's a great question. First of all, ideally, you would strip all subsidies and take a look at the problem then. We spend about four times as much subsidizing fossil fuel in this country as we do subsidizing renewable energy, but we subsidize them both. So it's not exactly an unlevel playing field so much as a really lumpy, weird one. Second, the value of energy depends on the market into which it's sold and the type of energy it is. So an electron delivered in Las Vegas at 4 in the afternoon on a 117-degree day is worth a lot more than an electron delivered at 2 in the morning in North Dakota or somewhere like, you know. So those answers, there's the it depends. Then there's the trends. Today's solar panels are more expensive than a new natural gas turbine, quite a bit more expensive, two or three times more expensive, but they've dropped 80% in the last 4 years. So what's your bet going to be on the next 4 years? And then natural gas prices are volatile. Solar prices are stable. I mean, sunshine prices are stable at zero. What's the price of volatility? If you're going to do a 20-year investment, do you think natural gas is going to be at $3.50 for 20 years, or do you presume it might go up or might go down? And what's the economic weight you put on that? Okay, enough caveats. You want the answer. So right now, on a new build basis, wind is competitive with gas and better than coal. In special circumstances, comprising about 15 to 18% of the electricity market, solar is cheaper than conventional sources. In other words, if you put it in an overloaded substation where you have a lot of sunshine, those are today's prices. Nobody's building any new coal-fired power plants because they're not economical, but people are building a lot of new natural gas-fired power plants. Natural gas turbines are very cheap, and natural gas is very cheap, and there's a lot of it. So natural gas is the biggest, it's actually now, interestingly, the second biggest marginal growth. Wind is now the biggest in America. It's growing faster. There's more installations of wind than any other technology, which is kind of amazing. Should I do 2 minutes on nuclear?
Sure. Go for it.
So you have to think of nuclear in three generations. Generation two, which is what we have everywhere, they're all being shut down in the next 20 to 30 years. Why? Because they become brittle after they're bombarded with radioactivity for that long. It has nothing to do with license extensions. They're cheap to operate. They're bloody expensive to repair because you have to repair them with robots. So they're going away. It's a physical fact, even in France. The third generation nuclear is what's being built now. They build one in Finland, they're building one in France, they're building a couple dozen in Asia. The problem with them is they're expensive. The one in Finland is going to cost $11 billion for one power plant, right? So factor of five more expensive than coal, factor of 15 more expensive than natural gas. So I predict that generation three is going to peter out after three or four dozen reactors. Then there's generation four. And generation four is really neat because it's small, it's modular, is proliferation resistant, it's cheap, it only has one problem. It doesn't exist. So they have to invent it. And I'm not pessimistic about this possibility, but it's a very serious technical challenge. And in fact, there's no one idea, there's about 10 ideas. So if we're serious about nuclear power having a future, and nothing I've said, by the way, is pro-nuclear or anti-nuclear, these are just numbers. If you're serious about having a nuclear future, you have to invest mightily in generation four and see if you can get there. And nobody's doing that.
This is very interesting. So I'm going to say a word about wind, then take a question or two in just the remaining minutes. So one of my ways I explore America, I'm a longtime small plane pilot. I have a little very fuel-efficient single-engine plane that I fly around the heartland. And so I've been over those places in North Dakota and Wyoming, which were astonishing. But when I was flying here from Sioux Falls, South Dakota, 5 days ago, it was astonishing. You cross the Nebraska to Colorado state line, and suddenly there are more windmills than you can count.
Yeah.
I must have seen 5,000 windmills in just that part of Colorado, which I assume is a state regulatory difference between Nebraska and Colorado, but there are windmills all over the place, and so that was cheering. A question over here.
I have a specific U.S. policy question. Given what you've said about the U.S.-Chinese relationship on climate change and so on, what's your perspective on debates in states like Montana on mining coal to export it to China, you know, to create employment?
Yes, exporting American coal, sending it to China. What's the over-under?
It's like playing Russian roulette with five bullets instead of six. I mean, it's like stupid. Really, people say coal is fungible. And if they don't buy it from us, they'll buy it from Australia. Well, there's people in Australia that would like to sell a little bit less coal to China as well, right? And you can have, I don't think morality at the end of the day is fungible, even if commodities may be. So we have to stop coal. There is no physical alternative if we want to save the earth.
But let me just press you on this. I will tell you as a matter of fact that if the United States doesn't sell them that coal, they are going to either mine it domestically or get it from somebody else.
Okay, but let's say half a dozen nations make it more difficult. Mm-hmm. Canada, Australia, the United States, and Indonesia. Indonesia is least likely. That's where they're getting their coal. Yeah. If those four nations make it more difficult, they've just raised the price of coal. They've put a carbon price on China.
Yeah.
That's pretty good. So it's not infinitely fungible. And the way you stop it is by starting to stand up for what's right.
Okay. We have time for one more question. Who has a microphone and a question? So I think over here. Yes.
Hi, thank you very much. I've been in a number of forums like this, and when they're talking about it, and you present a little different approach in that when people are talking about scaling, when they look at the problem, looking at scale, and they're saying that natural gas is probably the best way to scale immediately. And one of the things that they say, because they ask them about wind, and they say wind and solar, the thing that you're not talking about is the amount of land that it takes to do that. Is there any kind of a metric between what does it take in terms of acreage to replace a gas-fired plant as opposed to do that so strictly on solar or
right, the
or
energy
wind?
Density of wind is very different from coal and nuclear. Yeah.
So I don't want to be Pollyanna-ish about any of this. Look, every energy source has problems, and every energy source can be done badly. And you can put wind in a bird flight corridor and kill a lot of birds. That's dumb. We've learned how not to do that. You can run a transmission line through a proposed wilderness area. You can put solar panels on top of soon-to-be extinct turtles. And by the way, same with natural gas, same with coal, same with nuclear, right? So you can't get away from this question of how you do things in an ecologically and an economically intelligent way. You really have to pay attention. If you do things that are economically stupid in the name of a good cause, it will come back and whack you. It will crush itself. There's plenty of land to move to renewables without sacrificing environmental values. If you go to eastern Colorado, the highest, best use of eastern Colorado is a windmill. I mean, I'm sorry.
no offense.
And the windmill, by the way, takes up less than 10% of the space. You still got 90% for the farmers, and the farmers are really happy to have a new source of cash flow.
It's made it a lot harder, a lot trickier to fly around there, though. You got to go higher.
Well,
but yes.
Pull that stick back, Jim.
Yes.
Come on.
It's true. So we have 30 seconds left. You have 30 seconds to give a final thought to this influential crowd before they disperse.
So this one's winnable. If we fail, the consequences, I guarantee you, are far worse than you can imagine. Hundreds of millions of dead. We will reduce agricultural productivity in Africa by about a third by 2050 because of heat change alone, right? Imagine what that does. We can win this one. It's a huge job, but technology is finally on our side, and politics is moving on our side. And this is exactly the moment to pile on. This is the moment to pick up your phone, get on your computer, get your checkbook out, go to your board meetings, do what you have to do, but it's time to lock this one down.
Wise words. Thank you very much, Al Harvey.
Well, that about wraps up another episode of Savage Science Radio. And if you're listening to me, you're probably listening to it through the archive because this show ran long. It was good stuff, though. I'd like to thank Nick Palucco for the beautiful show graphics, Dennis Bond and Hawk Productions for that wonderful intro that we use every week, and none other than Todd Sheets, the executive producer of this show and owner of the Jackalope Network. And until next week, keep your powder and your pants dry, and happy trails to you.